And Radio Derb is on the air. Well, sort of. Yes, same deal as last week, listeners. I left the USA on September 9th and am currently, on September 20th, somewhere in China, either happily getting drunk with old friends or having my fingernails pulled out by Xi Jinping's secret police, depending on how much attention the Chai Coms have paid to the stuff I've been writing about them this past 36 years. Before leaving the States, I recorded 3 sessions of Radio Derb. Last week's, this week's, and next week's. Naturally, I couldn't make them very newsy and topical, so each one is a trip down memory lane. For these purposes, Memory Lane goes from May 2004 to April 2012, the 8 years that Radio Derb was hosted by National Review. Audio clips from the sound files for those years follow, bracketed by little pip-pip sounds. This week's theme is political. Those 8 years included 2.5 presidential election cycles, the last few months of the 2004 cycle, all of the 2008 cycle, and the first few months of the 2012 cycle. I'm hoping that by looking back at my commentary from those time spans, I may get some insight into how this current 2020 cycle will play out. There were midterms in there too, of course. I had things to say about them. Let's see. The 2004 presidential contest was between incumbent George W. Bush and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. There was a lot of fuss during the campaign over Kerry's war record. He had served as a Navy lieutenant for 4 years. For 4 months of that, he'd served in Vietnam, commanding a swift boat. That's a fast patrol boat working the rivers of the Mekong Delta. Kerry had engaged in combat and was decorated. Back in the States in the early 70s, though, he joined the anti-war movement, and in a demonstration with hundreds of other veterans against the war, he publicly threw away his medals. In the 2004 election, some of the men who'd served with him on the Swift boats claimed that he'd inflated his war service. Whether he had or not, I don't know, but it was a talking point all through the election campaign, along with other evidences of Kerry's cold opportunism. Hence the following, posted on National Review Online as part of my 2004 Christmas sing-along, but actually recorded on Radio Derb a couple of years later. Having started this week's broadcast with John Kerry, I may as well finish with him. Here is a little anti-Kerry song I wrote for the 2004 presidential campaign. It's modelled on an 18th century English song, The Vicar of Bray, which is about a country clergyman who boasts of having trimmed his sails to follow religious fashions all through the turbulent years from the late Stuart monarchs to the early Hanoverians. I called my song The Senator from Bray. In Lyndon Johnson's second term, when patriotism no harm meant, some resume points I had to earn, so off to Vietnam went. That country did its sights contrive unto my heart to sear. In just 4 months I'd medals 5, kick-starting my career. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother her to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir.
When Richard Nixon came along and war was out of fashion, I testified to grievous wrong with most indignant passion. To medals five goodbye I kissed, a book, try finding it, I wrote, and now would be a pacifist but for the VFW vote. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. While Ford and Carter struggled o'er a post-Vietnam confusion, I kept low profile as a lawyer in public prosecution. For in those times the public mood was harsh on politicians, while to relieve my solitude I sought out girls just rich ones. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. In Reagan's time I saw the chance to further my ambition, so to the Senate did advance a liberal patrician. My senatorial chores were few, no need for much attendance, just raise some funds and kiss up to Joe Kennedy's descendants. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother her to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. When George the First came to the fore with policies much sounder, I stood out firm against his war, believing it would founder. It didn't, but his previous vow, all taxes new to spare us, soon got me off the hook. Who now remembers judgment errors? And this is true, depend on me, don't bother her to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. Then dear Bill Clinton's fortune soared and liberal men were thriving. I got myself a loaded broad and lots of cars for driving. No military issues rose past follies to unbury. What happy golden days were those for lefties like John Kerry. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother to compete, sir. No matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. For George the Second's Iraq war I voted my approval, and cheered until my throat was sore at S. Hussein's removal. But liberal friends soon whispered that a quagmire was a-brewing, and in the ring I threw my hat to seek George II's undoing. And this is true, depend on me, don't bother to compete, sir, no matter who the POTUS be, I'll keep my Senate seat, sir. Imagine this, a noble vet, one with a sharp salute. He stands up in wartime to upset a man who shirked his duty. Alas, it's going all awry, just look at my position. The Swifties say my past's a lie, and Rather's blown his mission. Ah, well, what matters it to me, my buggy's in the ditch, sir, no matter who the POTUS be, I'll still be stinking rich, sir.
In late October 2006, I was not in the most elevated spirits, voter-wise.
To vote or not to vote? That is, of course, the question. Well, no, it's not really the question. Living out here in deep blue country, where the electoral choices on offer to me range from squishy left to Pol Pot, it really isn't worth the trouble. The real question for a chap of nation-spanning, election-swinging influence, such as myself, is whether to advise you to vote or not. I'll admit I'm pretty much at a loss. Of course, if your local ballot includes a candidate who might actually vote against making it a federal offence to pick your teeth, or a candidate who does not walk bow-legged under the weight of all the lobbyist money in his pockets, or a candidate who thinks that what's good for Americans ought to be far, far more important to our government than what's good for foreigners, or a candidate who delivers all his speeches in the same language our Constitution was written in, or heck, just a candidate who likes this country. Well, if you have one of those on your ballot, I hope you will go out and vote for him or her. I'm not so lucky here in Patakistan, though I'll probably drag myself to the polling place anyway, as there are a couple of decent types running for town and county offices. One of them, I'm told, is actually married to a person of the opposite sex and speaks English. Nowadays, you have to take what you can find.
By April of 2007, we had two good fields of candidates shuffling into position for the 08 election. And yes, they were setting up debates. Here I was on the April 27th, 07, Radio Derb, commenting on a Democratic candidates debate.
The eight candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination had a debate on the telly. Unfortunately, I missed it. The Uzbekistan folk dance troupe was on Channel 87, and one must make choices. So, off I go to Google News, search on debate transcript, and here we are, the whole thing. I'll just pick out some highlights. Let's see. John Edwards grew up really poor, and he wants everyone to have the opportunities he had. Who doesn't have them, John? Senator Obama promises Senator Gravel that he's not planning to nuke anybody right now. Well, that's a relief. That's certainly a relief to Mrs. Clinton. Bill Richardson held off on criticizing Alberto Gonzalez out of racial solidarity, Richardson's mom being Mexican, the same as Alberto Gonzalez's mom. Well, isn't that nice? Imagine a Republican presidential candidate saying he was holding back on criticizing Don Imus because, you know, white guys should stick together. Well, no, you can't imagine it. But the laws of nature are all different in a democratic universe. Richardson also said he would end the Iraq war on his first day in office, quote, with diplomacy. Plainly, the governor has never met a senior diplomat. It takes more than 24 hours for one of those critters to approve the menu for the next diplomatic banquet. Back to John Edwards. John Edwards really likes his wife and his father and God. Okay, Hillary Clinton thinks that hedge fund managers spend their spare time worrying about the poor and underprivileged. Senator, I've met some of these guys, and believe me, they don't. Chris Dodd is proud to come from a family that, quote, served in public service. He's proud, proud, proud that generations of Dodds have had their noses in the government trough, none of them ever holding down a real job. Mike Gravel, how do you say that? Gravel, thinks that nuclear war is immoral. That's one of those opinions that it makes sense to hold only if everybody else in the world also holds it. If you think nuclear war is immoral, then you or your children will quite likely be killed by someone who holds the opposite opinion. What else? Three of the debaters have never had a gun in their house. Hillary wants to bring illegal immigrants. Oh, can you guess where she wants to bring them? Right. Out of the shadows. She did actually say illegal immigrants, though, so we should be thankful for small mercies. Denis Kucinich wants you to know that he is very strongly connected to middle-class communities, as well as to Hair Club for Men. Everybody supports Roe v. Wade. Everybody thinks that the Supreme Court's token loony lefty, Ruth Ginsburg, is the ideal justice. Everybody wants to bring the troops home. These, ladies and gentlemen, are your Democrats who want to be President of the United States. And these are the things that they think it is important for you to know about them. Oh, the Uzbekistan folk dance troupe? Oh, they were great.
There was no incumbent president running in 08. The presidency was up for grabs by both parties. So, there were GOP candidates debates too. By September 2007, I was suffering from debate fatigue. Here I was, venting my boredom on September 7th that year, just about the same point in the 08 election cycle that we are right now at in the 2020 cycle.
Did you catch the Republican candidates' debate on Wednesday last? I'm just going to come right out and admit that I didn't. I don't even have an excuse. I made a mental note of the time, but the time came and went. I was reading a really absorbing book about British India, and I didn't feel like going downstairs to watch a bunch of law school grads boasting about how they'll fix what can't be fixed, spend money the nation hasn't got, and administer medication for maladies they can't diagnose correctly. Still, I hope it all went well. I hope that Rudy, who gets my vote as the least bad of the lot, put on a better performance than he has the previous times I've watched him debate. I hope Ron Paul reminded everybody of what the USA might be if we could just wind the tape back to 1960 and start over, which, alas, we can't. I hope Tom Tancredo, who's been right for years about what the rest of them have been wrong about for years, reminded them once again how out of touch they all are. I hope Duncan Hunter's seen the light on H-1B visas. Yo, Duncan, you import foreign workers for some line of work when we're short of natives to do it. And the only acceptable evidence of shortage should be that the wages offered for that work are going through the roof. I hope Mike Huckabee left his guitar at home. I hope nobody got asked about the theory of evolution, or for that matter about homological algebra, or asynchronous cellular automata, or neuroplasticity. I hope John McCain has stopped calling everybody his friend. I hope Mitt Romney didn't get his hair mussed. And I hope there will be more of these wonderful debates real soon. Real soon.
By mid-February 2008, we knew that Barack Obama would be the Democratic candidate for president that year. I was unimpressed.
Well, perhaps democracy's not that great if out of 300 million people we end up with John McCain and Barack Obama as choices for our head of state. Far too many people are being far too nice about Obama. The guy is a typical product of the 1980s college system, when our institutions of higher education had all been turned into PC madrasas, and all the poisonous flim-flam of identity studies and diversity indoctrination filled the campus air. That kind of atmosphere suited Obama to a T. He'd already spent 20 years obsessing about his own precious identity. Then off he went into work, if you'll pardon the expression, as a community organizer. And then as a lawyer representing what? Oh, community organizers. What else? Then back to the warm, scented bath of academic life, teaching law students how to help organise communities and how to litigate on behalf of, you know, community organisers. Reading Obama's resume makes me feel very glad I don't live in a community that needs organising by Ivy League grads whose heads are packed with PCBs. Now here's Obama gassing away about how he's going to unite us. What does that mean? He's going to persuade all the nation's conservatives to become liberals? Or is it a socialist thing? He's going to unite rich and poor by taxing the rich into poverty. Lots of luck with that, buddy. Or is the uniting going to be spiritual? Is he going to swing us all into line behind his own favourite pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, whose church's website says, quote, "We are an African people and remain true to our native land, the mother continent, the cradle of civilization." How is Obama going to bring in those renegade few of us who think that Americans should be true to, you know, America? Or is this uniting going to be a race thing? Is Obama going to bring black and white together at last? But the evidence is rather strong that black Americans and white Americans don't much want to be brought together. We watch different TV programs, we give our kids different names, we live in different parts of town and send our kids to different schools, and we drink different brands of beer. What's Senator Obama going to do about any of that? Bring back busing? Force white mothers to name their kids Deshaun and Tashika? Obama's campaign is hot air. All hot air and nothing but hot air. Unfortunately, a great many people seem to like hot air. I'd like to be able to say that the guy is such a clueless airhead that he can't do much harm. However, I remember saying exactly that about Jimmy Carter. I've been going around saying that no way I will vote for John McAmnesty. Getting a real look at Barack Obama now, I've got to say I feel my resolution wavering.
So, on November 4th, 2008, Barack Obama got elected president. Here I was, that Friday, on Radio Derb, reflecting on it.
Meanwhile, let's look back on the George W. Bush presidency. All right, I supported the guy in 2000. He was running against Al Gore, for heaven's sake. And then again in 2004. What was I supposed to do? 8 years of George W. Bush killed off my party loyalty, though. We have a decently healthy Conservative Party here in New York State, and I'm going to change my registration to it when I can face doing anything political again. What's the point of being a Republican? You elect a Republican president for 8 years, you give him a Republican Congress for 6 of those years, and what do you get? 2 pointless wars, huge new entitlements, $1 trillion deficits, 10 million illegal immigrants, Harriet Myers, Sarbanes-Oxley, No Child Left Behind, a push to increase minority home ownership by debauching bank lending standards, and Republican Congress critters staggering around the halls of Congress under the weight of backpacks that are loaded up with lobbyist money. If conservatives, and yes, I'm going to include myself here as not having been outspoken enough, if conservatives had divorced themselves from Bush after the 2006 elections, when it was clear how much the country hated him and his stupid policies, then there might have been the chance of a better result this week. Why was Obama's talk about change so popular? Nobody wanted change in 1988, after Ronald Reagan. This year, people were fed up with incompetence, mismanagement, and corruption. That's why they went for change.
Listen to a conservative friend of mine, old Washington DC veteran and National Review contributor Bruce Bartlett. Quote, "These last 8 years will eventually be viewed by conservatives as the greatest wasted opportunity in history." Now eclipsing Eisenhower's first 2 years, when there was an opportunity to repeal much of the New Deal, an opportunity that Eisenhower nixed. No wonder Republicans were thrown out in 1954. Why bother electing them if they're just going to maintain the status quo? End quote. I'm not quite ready to declare conservatism stone dead in the USA, but it's in the intensive care facility, and George W. Bush put it there.
One consequence of Obama's election was the Tea Party movement, whose first stirrings Radio Derb had noted in April 09, just a few weeks into Obama's presidency. The Tea Partiers represented the first major sign of the anti-elite populism that brought Donald Trump to power 8 years later. They were disliked equally by both cultural Marxists and the Republican establishment. They also generated the first spasm of openly nasty anti-populist feeling among cultural Marxists, the spasm that later manifested as Trump derangement syndrome. Progressives were particularly thrilled with their own wit for referring to the movement as tea baggers, apparently a reference to an intimate practice among male homosexuals. As promising as it seemed, the Tea Party movement was inchoate and ineffectual. It was easily co-opted by the Republican Party establishment, just as I predicted in this podcast segment from February 2010.
Speaking of tea, how's the Tea Party movement doing? Well, it seems to be pretty healthy, but the establishment counterattack is already underway. In all likelihood, it will prevail. You don't get to be an establishment without knowing how to play the game, and our elites are going to play this game for all they're worth. Bear in mind also that our elite is a meritocratic elite, which means they're smarter than the rest of us. Nothing is certain in politics, but the way to bet is that the elites will outfox and rout the Tea Party movement at last and reassert their hegemony. Radio Derb reported last week on dismaying signs that Sarah Palin, the Tea Party's darling, may already have had an establishment chip planted in her brain and be ready to join the globalist elites in regulating us to death, crushing free speech, tribalizing our society, abolishing our nation's borders, and all the rest of their nation-wrecking agenda. Now, here was Meghan McCain of The View telling us about the, quote, innate racism of the Tea Partiers. Well, that's funny. Meghan's dad thought that the much more explicit racism of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright was not a topic proper to be mentioned when he was contesting for the presidency with Reverend Wright's long-time parishioner and admirer, Barack Obama. If Meghan McCain had anything to say about that, I missed it. Middle-class conservative activists can be accused of racism, but far-left black radicals can't. That's the voice of the establishment. That's how much they care about conservatism. There will be a steadily rising number of attacks like this on the Tea Partiers from establishment shills like the McCains, with special emphasis on the Tea Partiers' supposed racism, because, number one,
The Tea Partiers, although by no means lily-white, are considerably whiter than America. About 5% black, 11% Hispanic, according to a poll commissioned by National Review. And number two, the racism charge is the one that most intimidates, in fact terrifies, ordinary middle-class Americans, who would rather be accused of cannibalism than racism. Thus intimidated, the less committed Tea Partiers will drift away in fear and discouragement. The rest will be co-opted into the Republican Party, subjected to a brief surgical operation to implant establishment chips in their frontal cortices, and will soon be happily voting for amnesty, cap and trade, and new wars, like good little McCainiacs. You think I'm being too pessimistic about the Tea Partiers' prospects? Stick around.
Here's a clip from September 2011, just the point in the 2012 election cycle that we are now at in this one. There had been a GOP candidates debate that week, and it included questions about immigration. What this part of the debate mainly revealed was the utter cluelessness of all the candidates about immigration issues. Then, as now, candidates' debates reach peak stupidity when they are asked questions about immigration. Here's a clip from September 2011, just the point in the 2012 election cycle that we are now at in this one. There had been a GOP candidates debate that week, and it included questions about immigration. What this part of the debate mainly revealed was the utter cluelessness of all the candidates about immigration issues. Then, as now, candidates' debates reach peak stupidity when they are asked questions about immigration.
The national question came up, and they wheeled in a chap named Jose Diaz-Balart to pose some of the questions. I found that annoying. What, is immigration a Hispanic fief now? I'm an immigrant, and my wife's an immigrant, and we come from two different countries, neither of which has Spanish as its language. Immigration's a big issue, with many important sub-issues. Legal immigration, illegal immigration, refugee resettlement, birthright citizenship, Muslim immigration, the green card lottery, assimilation versus multiculturalism, and so on. How did it get to be all about Hispanics? How did Hispanics get to own the immigration issue? It's like blacks owning the poverty issue, as if there were no poor white people. In fact, the immigration issue seems to be mostly about Mexicans. Among liberal commentators, the kind of folk who work at MSNBC, which was hosting the debate, the word immigrant is well nigh a synonym for illegal immigrant from Mexico. That's ridiculous, and it leaves out far too many important issues. That's why I'm annoyed. Anyway, there was Mr. Diaz-Balart, who, by the way, is not Mexican. He's American-born of Cuban parentage. There he was, asking the candidates about immigration issues, as if this was one of those jobs that non-Hispanic Americans won't do. The candidates were, for the most part, depressingly clueless about the issue. Newt Gingrich said he thought we should have a legal guest worker program. As I once pointed out to him, we already have 12 guest worker programs, covering every line of work from fruit picking to orchestra conducting. Why would we need another one? But Newt just likes the sound of that phrase, guest worker program, and he doesn't want to be confused with the facts. Rick Santorum said, quote,
We should not have a debate talking about how we don't want people to come to this country. End quote. Wrong. That's exactly the debate we should have, Rick. Does the USA have all the people it needs, or does it need more? You may reasonably take this side or that on the question, but you may not reasonably say that, quote, we should not have a debate. Our immigration laws were very restrictive from 1945 to 1965, and the nation prospered mightily. That low levels of immigration are a bad thing is therefore not obvious. Contra Rick Santorum, it's debatable, and it should be debated. I did perk up a bit when Rick Perry talked about having predator drones patrolling the Mexican border. Then my spirits sagged again when it was clear that he just wants them to do passive surveillance. I had something else in mind, but oh well. Mitt Romney did an awkward straddle. He started off saying we need a total border fence, which is right. But then he pulled out the line about, quote, they can always get a ladder to go over the fence. So what's the point of the fence, Mitt? And how come the fence that the Israelis built along their border works just fine? What, Arabs didn't invent the ladder yet? Mitt came back with a glimmer of sense at the end, though. Quote, we've got 4.7 million people waiting in line legally. Let those people come in first, and those that are here illegally, they shouldn't have a special deal. End quote. If any of the questioners at the debate had half a clue, that might have led into some discussion of legal immigration. But, as Rick Santorum pointed out, legal immigration is not a fit subject for debate among right-thinking people. Ron Paul fumbled the issue. Quote, I think this fence business is designed and may well be used against us and keep us in. End quote. You really think that, Congressman? You think it'd be like the Berlin Wall, with brave Americans struggling to climb over the fence to freedom in Mexico, while Border Patrol takes shots at them? I yield to no one in my suspicion of federal power, but that's too much even for me. I did like the silver dime idea, though.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen, for this second dip into the Radio Derb archives. Thank you for listening. I hope I brought some little shards of the political past to life there. The third and final such dip will be next week, when my theme will be the culture. The week after that, October 4th, Radio Derb will be back to the normal schedule, commenting on current events as usual.